We do not find it easy, gracious God, but we shall try this morning to thank you for prayers to which an answer came that was different from the one we wanted. We remember that we asked for happiness, always happiness, but we have learned that in occasional sorrow, we found a deeper self. We wanted health, always health, but you insisted at times that we discover the secret treasures of pain, and in the anguish of some of our days, we came to understand the shadows at the heart of life and how much the sunlight is worth. We wanted to win, but when the answer was no, we joined a great company of people who were made stronger simply by doing their best. We wanted wealth, all kinds, except the kind that costs so much, the wise and compassionate heart. But being turned down, some of us had from you a better gift than we had requested. So for prayers not answered as we had hoped, for the higher gift that only the wisest love can grant, we thank you in his name who asked once that he might be spared and who heard from out the silence the same no that we must sometimes hear. Hear our hearts a moment more in this quiet time. The title for my comments this morning actually constitute a rather weak pun. I borrowed them from a woman named Trudy Bush, an associate editor for the Christian Century, who wrote an article 4 months ago about the profitability of angels. All of a sudden, in the American free enterprise system, if you thought books about the O.J. Simpson trial were big business, her essay makes it clear that those books are only a trickle compared with the flood tide of stories about angels in television, newspapers, magazines, and books. I found myself so interested in this phenomenon that I decided to turn it into a sermon, for which you may decide later I need forgiveness. I am a teacher this morning rather than a motivator. As I read around about angels in the Bible and in literature, I came across three now forgotten English poets who compared our brief moments of happiness as human beings to the visits of angels. Short and bright, one of them said. Few and far between, another one put it. They left no clue as to what they may have meant by the word angel, but they obviously believed that encounters with angels were very rare. That analogy would be hopelessly out of style in America in 1995, because angelic appearances are, as Hollywood likes to say, hot. In the past 5 years, according to the Gannett News Service, angel books in print have gone from 5 to at least 200. And in religious book and gift shops, the shelves are groaning under terracotta angels, painted angel plaques, angel pins and pendants, and angel calendars, whatever they are. To put it crassly, angels have suddenly become a multi-million-dollar business. It is only fair, before I go any further, to make my personal bias clear about contemporary angel lore. Before we were lucky enough to engage Kathy Penny as our church secretary, we briefly employed a nice woman from another church who demonstrated this wildly popular current trend by promptly installing two little terracotta angels on the window ledge and a large picture of an angel on the wall. They were, how else can I say it, bland, sentimentalized, simpering creatures, which I could hardly bear to look at. You need not share my taste or my theology, but I viewed all three of them as far less interesting than the angel lore one can read about in the Bible. And I was delighted when the window ledge and the wall were no longer their resting places. I am in complete agreement with a fine Catholic scholar, Lawrence Cunningham, chairman of the Department of Theology at Notre Dame, who says to move angels center stage is to trivialize Christianity. Now, that's an interesting thing for a Catholic theologian to say. And my sermon this morning is dedicated to explaining why this one would make that statement. To begin with, the angels of the 90s bear little, if any, resemblance to angels mentioned occasionally in the Bible. As the Catholic professor points out, angels seem to be friendly folks only if we haven't read the Bible carefully. He has obviously read his Bible well enough to know the difference between the soft, sentimental pablum currently passing for angel lore and the tough, demanding, not always welcome messengers portrayed in the Bible. For one thing, of course, when these messengers appeared to human beings in a biblical narrative, they were given such ordinary attributes that they were often mistaken for traveling mortals who had dropped in for a visit. Never anything as exciting as the ones described to the Wichita 20th Century Club one time years ago by a man from Argentina who claimed that flying saucers may be piloted by angels sent to earth to determine who is saved when Jesus returns in the year 2002. Like most people who claim to have seen angels, this man had no doubts about how they looked. A few had heads like pumpkins, he told his audience, but most of them were about 9 feet tall, handsome, blonde, blue-eyed, and for reasons I have not fathomed, transparent from the waist down. Angels in our male chauvinistic Bible are invariably masculine. But this gentleman had a charming story about an Argentine truck driver who saw a female angel while changing a tire and told authorities she was the most beautiful creature he had ever looked at. The people who wrote the Bible would have been absolutely amazed at that comment. Even more amazed to have seen little cherubs like this one, which my granddaughter brought down as a tease from KU after she heard me speak of the neutered angels housed for a few weeks in our church office. This one is also neutered, as most are now in deference to modern sensibilities. My granddaughter, I can't pass this one around later or invite you to see it because my mischievous granddaughter denutered this one before she gave it to me. This one also has the inevitable set of wings. Despite the fact, please hear this carefully, that no angel, repeat, no angel who visits a mortal in a biblical story is ever said to have had wings. We'll have a footnote later on that point. The gap between the biblical world and ours is so enormous that we must now take a few minutes to describe it. Any serious student of the Bible knows that the early books of our Old Testament were profoundly influenced by the religion of Babylon, the country from which the Hebrew people migrated. The earliest known image of anything like a divine messenger shows some of them flying over the head of a Babylonian king standing at prayer. This is almost certainly where the Hebrews got their notion of divine messengers, just as they also borrowed from the Babylonian story of the flood and the Tower of Babel and parts of their creation epic. It's important right now to remind you that the Hebrew and Greek words which we translate angel meant literally, simply, a messenger. These messengers from the gods were common all over the Near East. Egyptians, Mesopotamians, Hittites, Persians all had winged creatures mediating in some fashion between the many gods of that time and their human worshippers. Iris and Hermes were the original Greek angels who carried messages for the gods. Hermes, we know him best by his Roman name Mercury, wore little wings on his sandals to signal his function. You can still see them on the floral telegraph delivery symbol. Like all such creations, these were modeled on the life patterns people knew about. In these cases, as in the Bible, on the patterns of court life. Since the king sat on a throne, high and lifted up, it made sense that the gods did the same. Since the king had messengers who did his bidding, so surely must the gods. Some 14 centuries before Christ, an Egyptian king, Amenhotep IV, decided he believed in only one god instead of the many which his ancestors had worshipped. Since he could not do away with all those extra gods, he simply demoted them and let them hang around doing odd jobs for his single chief deity. In other words, he created angels. The same thing happened to the Persian gods who were unseated when the prophet Zoroaster in the 6th century declared that Ahura Mazda was the one and only god. He found it impossible to throw out all the gods his people had honored for generations. So he declared some of them to be good spirits and others to be demons, and Persia had its contingent of angels, and it also had the dualism which came from that country into Jewish thought. When I see many other kinds of Jewish indebtedness to neighboring cultures, it comes as no surprise that the angels of the Bible are a combination of divine messengers pictured in bas-reliefs from Assyria and Babylon and mentioned in tales from both Egypt and Persia. The combination, I can tell you, makes it almost maddening to try to discover what an angel was supposed to look like in the Bible. Ezekiel, whose imagination was so extraordinary that some fairly serious biblical scholars have thought he might have been on something when he wrote, had a vision of certain beings he called cherubs, not the ordinary biblical angels, but cherubs, creatures with four wings and four faces, ox, man, eagle, lion, all accompanied by whirling wheels. These bizarre things were also said to guard the tree of life in the Garden of Eden, and wooden images of them overlaid with gold and with their wings outspread guarded the Ark of the Covenant. This is a rarely noticed verse, but according to the 18th Psalm, the God of the Old Testament, Yahweh himself, sometimes flew through the sky, according to that writer, mounted on the back of a cherub. These creatures, with their half-human, half-animal shapes, are straight out of Babylonian mythology. You can see pictures of them on ancient Phoenician ivories and on old temple walls. The cherubs guarding the tree of life in Genesis sound and look like the dragon creatures who guarded the entrance to Babylonian and Assyrian temples. I have a striking picture in my office of a pair of winged cherubs supporting the throne of Hiram, a Phoenician king who is mentioned in the Bible. There are still other biblical oddities known as seraphs, seen by Isaiah in one of the most dramatic of all Hebrew vision stories. These creatures had six wings, two to cover their faces, two to cover their feet, raglaim. The Hebrew word is actually a euphemism for their private parts, which it is assumed they possess, and two more wings to fly with. They are mentioned only one time in the Bible because they are early relics of Hebrew borrowing, and they were soon to be left behind as angelology evolved and became more sophisticated. The Jewish people usually toned down the more bizarre aspects of what they borrowed. So whenever in their sacred writing a divine messenger visits a human being, that messenger has no wings at all, cannot, as I have said, easily be distinguished from ordinary mortals. Abraham, we're told, entertained three angels one day, and yet saw nothing to make him in the least suspicious. They acted like men, they enjoyed eating with him, and it was taken for granted that they spoke whatever language he spoke. It was only when they told Sarah she would have a child, despite her advanced age, that Abraham and his wife decided they had been hosting messengers from the Lord. Such experiences seem to run in that family. Abraham's nephew, Lot, who lived in Sodom, invited two strangers one day to stay for the night. He sees no wings or even nubs of wings, and the two guests look and act just like any other male mortals. Still another relative of Abraham's, his grandson Jacob, wrestles all night with what he calls an angel, although he never felt so much as a feather. This strangely archaic messenger with whom Jacob was said to have wrestled is apparently afraid of the daylight, although other angels seem quite comfortable even at high noon. The point I'm trying to make is that it's all quite confusing. Still another story tells how Jacob has a dream and sees angels going up and down a ladder, sometimes translated a staircase. Now the teller of that story obviously did not think of angels as creatures with wings, since if they had been able to fly, there would have been no need for a ladder for them to travel on up and down between earth and heaven in his dream. One of the most puzzling of all the stories of Hebrew mythology is that curious paragraph in Genesis about the mating of divine beings with mortal women. It reads like this: when mankind began to increase and to spread all over the earth, and daughters were born to them, the sons of the gods saw that the daughters of men were beautiful. So they took for themselves such women as they chose. It is a Hebrew euphemism for saying they mated. Nothing is said about how the sons of men reacted to this unfair competition, since the biblical writer is only trying to explain how it happened that there were giants in the earth in early legends. He does it the same way the Romans and the Greeks did it. Any man or woman abnormally gifted must have been the offspring of a union between gods and mortals. And it would be helpful today as a way of explaining people like Michael Jordan and Annie Dillard. I thought you would smile at least. Except for the strange book of Revelation in the New Testament, where angels have swords going out of their mouths and are full of eyes before and behind, Christian scripture treats angels a little less sensationally than the Hebrews, but there are still moments of confusion. The four writers, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, who describe what happened on the resurrection morning, do not agree on how many messengers were at the grave. And the two who do agree in having only a single messenger seem to be split on whether that one was an ordinary mortal or a divine being. For Matthew, the visitor is apparently supernatural, with radiant garments. For Mark, he seems as human and believable as Bill Rainey taking an elevator at Bank 4. It may help a little in all this confusion to know that even in the time of Christ, belief in angels was not unanimous among his people. The Pharisees, who were close to the common folk, believed in them. But the more aristocratic Sadducees, who held the office of the high priest and ran the temple complex, did not believe in them at all. If you are still traveling with me, I remind you a second time that both the Hebrew and Greek words, which we translate as angel, meant simply a messenger, and some comments make it clear that this messenger need not be a living thing. One of the Psalms gives a useful hint. The writer has seen crops and cattle destroyed. And in the usual Jewish way of attributing all such things directly to God, he says, God let loose on them his wrath, his fierce anger, his distress, a company of destroying angels. In other words, all sorts of happenings like drought and pestilence, which we would call perfectly natural, were seen as agents of God and called angels. Depending on the structure of one's mind, a messenger of God might be personified as a winged hybrid or an ordinary mortal, but it might also be a dream or a vision. It might be an abnormally wet spring or any other strange and disturbing event or coincidence. I cut out a couple of minutes here for your sake, so I'll see how smooth the transition is at this moment. It isn't far from such comments to belief in guardian angels, despite the fact that both the New Testament and the early theologians had very little to say about them. Millions believe in them, especially as children. But for thoughtful adults, and I beg you to hear this comment with care, for thoughtful adults, they raise excruciating problems about divine providence. Mother Mary Angelica, who now owns a cable TV network, says she met her first guardian angel at age 11 while crossing the street on her way home from school. She says, I felt myself lifted by invisible hands out of the path of a car. A devout Catholic woman whose child was struck and killed by a car the day before would be understandably puzzled as to why her child's guardian angel failed. Logic, of course, stands little chance against the widespread craving for stories of angelic rescues, so many of which involve traffic hazards that one commentator wondered how angels occupied themselves before the invention of automobiles. Almost invariably, the stories pander to human pride and egocentrism from which religious faith has always tried to warn us. Focusing on what angels can do for us rather than on what they prompt us to do for others. A woman named Sophie Burnham, in an extraordinarily soppy book called Angel Letters, says they play with us, look after us, heal us, comfort us with invisible warm hands, and always try to give us what we want. Now, whatever confusion one may find over the centuries when the Bible was being written, there is nothing comparable to the current flood of warm fuzzies about angels. The modern message is, don't worry, things are working out perfectly. The cosmos is a happy place where there is no need for us to look out for each other, to work for justice, or to wrestle with evil. Our Notre Dame professor, who spoke of how this trivializes religion, had probably seen the story in which a guardian angel helps a tired mother change the sheets on her child's bed. Biblical messengers challenged people to change their lives or make some sacrifice.